So Matt did a very nice introduction for me last week, but he introduced my public face to you. And what I want to bring here is my Buddhist face, not my public face. And I keep them distinct because, you know, I have a professional life. I teach philosophy at a university that wants me to teach philosophy, not Buddhist practice, for example, this sort of thing. So the face that I want to present to you is the face that my teachers have seen. And so I want to take a minute to talk about my teachers, because what I taught last week and what I want to teach this week really depends upon what I learned from them and then what I tried to put into practice over the last 30-some years, successfully or not, whatever the case may be. So because this is an FPMT center, it's important that I say that the beginning of my Tibetan practice lineage is with Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa, because they were my refuge lamas at the same time, I guess, because they showed up in Bloomington, Indiana, and I think it was 1976 in the summer. And a bunch of posters ended up on bulletin boards and on trees and whatnot in Bloomington, Indiana, which is where I was living, saying there was going to be a two-week retreat out in the countryside at a park with these two lamas that nobody had ever heard of. But it didn't really make any difference, because about 40 or 50 hippies, including myself, showed up for this two-week retreat. And that was the beginning of my connection with that particular Tibetan lineage. But it happened just before I began working on a PhD in Central Asian studies. So it was a very fortuitous time. At that point, when I was working on my doctorate, toward the end of that time, I started working on a translation of a Nagarjuna text. And that took me to Dharamsala several years later to clarify some things that hadn't gotten sorted out when I was working on my doctorate and completing it. And that's where I started studying with Geshe Sonam Rinchen at the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives. And Geshe-la really became my Madhyamaka teacher, because I met with him over two summers and we revised the translation. We met every day for months and we talked about how to interpret this Nagarjuna text. And he was the most wonderful teacher. He was amazing. When I first met him, I said, I've come here because I have this problem that I cannot resolve that's in the text. And I won't go into what that is now. And I said, nobody that I've talked to, i.e. no Western scholars that I've talked to, have been able to help me understand what this problem is and what the solution to this problem is. And he looked at me and he said, well, there are three answers to that. Which one do you want? And I thought, holy cow, I'm in the right place. United States, no answers. Dharamsala, three answers. Okay. So my understanding of Nagarjuna is very, very greatly based upon the fortunate time that I had with him. Toward the end of that time, I met Tara Tulku Rinpoche, who was retired abbot of Gyuto Tantric College at that point. And I met him because he was coming to Amherst College, which is where I was working, to tutor Bob Thurman. Okay, now Bob has Okay, I saw that. I mean, Bob has the kind of eminence that he can go to the Dalai Lama and say, will you find me a Lama to teach me Guhya Samaja? And the Dalai Lama sends him the retired abbot of Gyuto. So then I had an opportunity to study just about everything over a six-month period in Amherst with Tara Tulku. However, he refused to teach me any tantra, which was very interesting. I asked him three times, would you teach me Manjushri practice? Because I need a sharp mind to understand Nagarjuna. He's driving me crazy, even after all this time with with Gen Sonam Rinchen. And he said no. And he said no three times. And I thought, well, that's it. I mean, I've asked three times, I've been refused three times, and so that's the end of it. But I met him again in the San Francisco area about 4 years later, and when he was teaching at Green Gulch Zen Center. And curiously, that's also where I met my wife, but not quite at that moment. At that point, he said, yes, I will teach you to do a meditation practice when I come back in a year or two. So then I began to study Vajrayana with him. And I did four retreats on Yamantaka under the supervision of Taratoko along with Kay. And a lot of what I have to say about Vajrayana practice comes out of my being his student. So that's why I need to mention that. But also what I say about Vajrayana practice or tantric practice is merged with my understanding of middle way thought, Madhyamaka, Nagarjuna thought, okay? Because in the tradition it's said that in order to practice Vajrayana, in order to practice Tantra, you have to have a firm grounding in the philosophy of emptiness, in middle way philosophy. Of course, you have to have firm grounding in many other things. You have to do preliminary practices and purifications and what have you. But you really must have a philosophical grounding. It's very, very important to understand how the practice works. Because lacking that, there are many things that simply don't make any sense at all. So as I'm talking, I will be bringing those different things together. When Tara Rinpoche died, Kay and I were sort of at a deep loss about how to go forward. But through some very fortuitous circumstances, we were able to start studying with Denmalocha Rinpoche, who took us on as his students. So very fortunate indeed, right? Lhotse Rinpoche wouldn't do retreats with us exactly, but he would meet with us. And we spent a lot of time with him in India and then in the United States. And I mention him for two reasons, besides the fact that he's one of my two main gurus. And so, of course, I have to mention him because there's nothing without the Lama. But that, in fact, is the point. With Lhotse Rinpoche, I really began the practice of Guru Yoga, which I didn't really understand and I didn't really do with Tara Rinpoche because I was too much of a philosopher and I wasn't yet enough of a practitioner, even after all of those retreats, which is really very bizarre and very extraordinary. But that only speaks to my own limitations. It doesn't speak to anything about them. But with Lhotse Rinpoche, I really practiced Guru Yoga. And he took care of us. He watched over us. And he gave us the energy to continue in our practice until he died a couple of years ago. The other thing that's relevant, again, because this is an FPMT practice place, is that Lhotse Rinpoche is one of Lama Zopa's teachers. So in a very funny way, I'm kind of intertwined in this FPMT world in ways that are very mysterious. And that's about the only thing I can say about it because it's all very mysterious and there are many things that I don't understand. But that's okay. I don't have to understand everything, that's for sure. Okay, so that's my Buddhist face and it's a tradition in the Tibetan tradition, you sort of speak to your bona fides before you begin teaching. And so those are, to the extent I have any, my bona fides. These are my lamas. These are my teachers. And I spent a little time talking about this because my understanding is that this is probably not the last time I'll be teaching here. So I wanted to go on record to share that information with people so you know where I'm coming from. So I teach like a professor, but I don't think like one. Okay. In fact, I'm not really a very rational person if you get right down to it, which has caused me unending difficulties. But I'm I'm a devotee, and I have very, very deep devotion to my lamas and to the Dharma. And so I teach from that. And so if things don't always make sense because the synapses aren't working in my brain, I'm 73, what do you expect, you know? But on the other hand, I rely on the inspiration of my teachers. Welcome. So the first thing that I'd like to do by way of getting into today's talk in a formal sense is recap what I talked about last week, because this really is a continuation. And then I want to check in with everybody and see where your comfort zone is or where your understanding is with the three main concepts that I presented last week, because those are the springboard from which I'll move this week. Okay, so there's no sense jumping off the springboard unless the board is solid, really. Okay, so the three concepts I presented last week were, in the highest yoga tantra, it's called taking death, intermediate state, and rebirth into the path. But I talked about it as much from the point of view of the three bodies of the Buddha, the Dharmakaya, the Sambhogakaya, and the Nirmanakaya, for whom, if that makes sense to anybody, or the three stages of consciousness we go through in a 24-hour period, which is our waking consciousness, which we have now, which is similar to the Nirmanakaya, our dreaming consciousness, which is similar to the Sambhogakaya, and our deep sleep, no dream consciousness, which Westerners call unconsciousness, which is similar to the Dharmakaya. Similar is a very important word here, okay? The other concept that I presented was the relationship of consciousness and wind energy, what we typically just call energy, or in the Western philosophical canon, it might be called elan vital or libido. In Hindu terms, it would be shakti or prana. And in East Asia, it would be called chi or ki. Okay. It really, as far as I can tell, all refers to the same thing. And the relationship, and this is the Tibetan teaching on this, is that of horse and rider, that the energy is the horse, consciousness is the rider. The rider directs the horse, that is to say, your consciousness directs the energy, and the energy carries the consciousness, and they're always in relationship with each other. You never find one without the other. And of course, as I've mentioned, the philosophical question is, what actually is their relationship? Are they two aspects of the same thing? Are there two things that are always in common with each other? And my lamas have always said, yep, there's several thoughts about that particular question. Take your pick. And so I've thought a lot about that. That's been one of the really important questions in my spiritual life. And I'll share some of my thoughts about that within the context of Madhyamaka, because that's very important. The third thing that I talked about was Guru Yoga, or Lama Chopa, might be the way you're familiar with it, which is the relationship that's cultivated between the student and the teacher, the student and the Lama. So, having said that, were there questions that came up for you either last week when we were here together that didn't get answered, or that it have kind of popped around or moved around in your mind since then that we might want to address before going forward at all? So, anyone? Even Anil? No? Yeah.
Well, so I had the question from last time.
Sure.
So, which is, I think, another way to talk about that, when I was asking about what Geshe shared as a very modern and cool example for his Western students about doing Guru Devi Yoga, for example, with Tara. And then he says it's a little bit like dialing Tara on the phone, the Zafa, and then she answers.
Right.
And this is how the relationship is functioning. And for me, I always thought that really struck me, and I thought a lot about dependent arising and how that functions in Guru Yoga.
Is that a question?
I give it to you. Because you said we were going to talk about it this session. So I'm handing off. And you can say no.
Let me think about the best place to put the answer to that question, whether I try and answer it now or I try and answer it in context. Let me answer it in context. Okay. And if I don't do a good job of answering it, or if I kind of move around it without kind of pinning it down, let me know. I will say that I think dialing Tara on the cell phone and getting an answer is maybe more about the lower tantras and not highest yoga tantra. Because in highest yoga tantra, it's more like you call Tara on the cell phone and she sort of pops out of the screen and jumps into you. And you and Tara become one. I looked at the Tara sadhana that you all do here before today's talk. And what struck me is there is no place in that sadhana where you and Tara as such, as the image of Tara and you actually become one. There are a lot of places where lights come into you.
She dissolves into you.
Does she, or? And do you arise as Green Tara when you do that?
So generally we don't do that at the center, but like the instruction I give to you on Tuesdays, that's where you would do, that's where you would arise if you have the initiation. And then for everybody else, then Tara would appear at the heart.
So for the sake of the recording and people who would not have heard Charmaine, what she was saying was that if you haven't had the initiation into Green Tara, then Tara comes to the top of your head and blesses you with light, which is to say wind energy. And if you have had the initiation, then she appears in your heart and then you and she become one.
I'm so sorry, David. I'm going to just be a little more precise because I think I was unclear. So it's after the light. So you do the purification with light, and then you do the simultaneous light purification. And then she dissolves into your pure light consciousness, or into your heart center, or whatever the visualization would be if you had taken initiation. Like, and then from there, you have this idea that your mind and the guru's mind and Tara's mind are one. And then there you can arise as a deity, or she appears.
So the distinction between having the initiation and not is whether she stays in your heart
or
you become her.
Precisely.
Okay, well that's great, because one of the things that I wanted to talk about today was how to practice if you haven't had the initiation. And thank you, Charmaine, you've just answered the question. So I don't have to answer that question. But it's very important, because one of the things that came up last week was I was stressing the need for initiation, and so people were saying, well, okay, what do I do if I don't have the initiation? And so that's the answer to the question. In regards to Green Tara, you go through this entire process, which is quite similar to what happens in highest yoga tantra. Tara appears in your heart, and you hold her in your heart. So she and you are separate in a certain way, right? And if you've had the initiation, then there's no longer a need for separation. You and she and the guru become one, right? Which is sort of the segue into where I wanted to go anyway with talking about the guru and guru yoga. But before I quite do that segue, there's something else that I want to share. And that's the that's something that Tara Rinpoche was teaching on one of our retreats, which I came across when I was reviewing some materials recently from the retreats. And he was saying that, the deep sleep state is not exactly the same as the Dharmakaya. In deep sleep, you're aware of nothing. The distinction between the Indo-Tibetan view of what happens when you're asleep and not dreaming and the Western view of what's happening at that point is the Western view is you're unconscious. You are not conscious of anything. The Indo-Tibetan view, and this is throughout not just, and I say Indo-Tibetan because it's not just the Tibetan Buddhist view, but it's also the view in the major schools of Indian thought. When you're in dreamless sleep, you're aware, you're conscious, but there's nothing to be aware of because your mind and senses are not functioning. Because your mind and senses aren't functioning, there's no data, there's no information that's coming to your awareness. But it doesn't mean your awareness has gone away. It means you're aware of nothing. And this is a really critical point because within those traditions, there is this idea that consciousness is neither created nor destroyed at any time. In the Buddhist view specifically, the argument for there have to be former and future lives is that consciousness is indestructible. It changes, it transforms, but it never ends, it never disappears. So it doesn't disappear or end in dreamless sleep, unlike the Western view. Because it doesn't end in dreamless sleep, it has continuity. That quality is guaranteed. But if that quality is guaranteed, it means that it had to exist before you were born also. And it means it has to exist after you die. That's actually the fundamental argument for reincarnation, if you get right down to it. There are little subtleties to that argument, because it's also described as being a momentary phenomenon. But that gets us into Madhyamaka, and I don't want to go quite there right now. But the main point is continuity, right? Now, so this is incredibly alien to the standard Western view of things, and it's very important to recognize its significance, okay? Now, dreaming sleep, dream, is similar to the Sambhogakaya, but it's not the same as the Sambhogakaya. But it gives you an idea of what Sambhogakaya is like, which is to say, in dream, it's like you exist in the Buddha world of Tara. It's like you exist in the Buddha world of Manjushri or Chenrezig. You don't know it most of the time, because mostly what we meet in our dreams is somebody else. Doesn't mean you can't meet them in your dreams, or you might meet them in disguise in your dreams, but you don't necessarily see them as such. That has to do more with our impurities rather than the reality of what's going on with the Sambhogakaya yidams or Buddhas. As you know, I don't like the word deity, so I'm not going to use it, even though you find it in the sadhanas, because it's tainted with Western connotations and denotations, so I tend to avoid it. Okay. Waking consciousness is like the nirmanakaya. Okay. Now, the reason I'm reiterating these things again is a question came up to Tara Rinpoche, and I didn't write down the question, I only wrote down the answer. His answer was, you can practice with these three states of consciousness as if they are the Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Nirmanakaya. You can practice with them and they can function efficiently because on a daily basis, you will be able to, or you are able to get a lot done to function very successfully on the basis of your sense of ego self, even though your ego self doesn't really exist in the way in which you think it exists either. So just as the ego self can be functional in the conventional world, you can use it to accomplish things, you can use the similitude of the Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Dharmakaya as represented in those three states of consciousness that I was discussing, to achieve things, which is to say, achieve an understanding of emptiness. So you can achieve an understanding that deep dreamless sleep is like the Dharmakaya, even though it isn't exactly the Dharmakaya, and you can gain a lot of realization, just as you can buy a pizza on the basis of your not actually really ego self. I just mentioned that because somebody was just walking across the parking lot from Back Road Pizza holding pizza box, got my attention. So do you understand this point? This turns out to be a very important point, Because otherwise you can ask yourself, well, if I'm a Buddha when I'm in deep dreamless sleep, what am I doing with the rest of my time? I don't really have to do any practice. I'm a Buddha every night for however many hours you manage to sleep. Well, you're not really a Buddha every night for however many hours you manage to sleep. As elders, some of us sleep more, some of us sleep less. But that doesn't make us more of a Buddha or less of a Buddha. It just gives us more or less opportunity in some interesting ways to practice what it's like to have a consciousness that's unified, that's undistracted by diversity, because that's consciousness of nothing. It's undistracted by diversity. Similarly, and perhaps more importantly for the way we mostly practice, you know, you can use the kind of consciousness that's involved in dream to practice what it's like to encounter the Sambhogakaya Buddhas like Tara, or to become a Sambhogakaya Buddha like Tara, because you have that similitude, okay? So once again, I want to stop and be sure that we're all kind of getting this, because it might sound a little strange, but actually if you work with this concept long enough, it again, as in many things in Tantra, it becomes very, very profound. So let me stop at this point and check in with everybody. We're all good?
Yes?
No. No, not unless you harass me, but questions are okay.
So, I mean, this is it makes me think of the instruction to practice all the time once you are practicing the Vajrayana, to see everything as in the nature of the mandala, so that you are the deity, everyone that you see is in the nature of, the yidam, everyone that you see is like an enlightened being, that you're in a pure land. And so is this a little bit like what we're talking about here?
Yes.
That we're using, okay.
Yes, it is. Okay. So again, for folks that are listening to this recording, Charmaine was... What?
I was like, please don't say my name again. Whoever listens to this is like, that girl never shuts up.
They just get to know you.
I actually appreciate the interaction. So from my point of view, you don't need to feel concerned. So the instruction, to repeat this, the instruction in Vajrayana is to practice as if you are in the mandala all the time, to practice as if you're in the pure land all the time, to see everything as pure, see everybody as a yidam, as it were. So everybody you see is Tara. Whether they're man or woman doesn't make any difference. They're Tara. Everybody you see is Akshobhya Buddha. Doesn't make any difference, you know, what their gender is, what their color is, whether they're deeply immersed in ignorance and doing awful things, or they're wonderful lama, you know, supreme beings. Doesn't matter. That this is the nature of everybody. And what that means is, from my point of view anyway, is that you're bringing together the consciousness of dream or the dream state and the consciousness of waking. You're bringing those two things together through your imagination. See, imagination is very powerful. Imagination is fundamental to doing Vajrayana practice. Usually imagination gets a really bad rap, you know, in the modern world. Like, oh, I'm sitting in classroom in high school and I'm daydreaming. That's bad news, right? Or I'm sitting on the bus, as I used to do in San Francisco, and I'd be doing this kind of practice of trying to see everybody else on the bus in a kind of a pure way, which would be okay until I missed my stop, right? You know, and the bus driver would give me some grief because they'd say, wait, can't you stop? No, Muni never stops. You get off at the next whatever it is. And that's, you know, I mean, that's reasonable. They can't just stop any place just because they have a spaced out commuter, from their point of view, spaced out commuter. So I don't know if I answered the question or not, but I agreed with you that yes, that is the way you practice. And it is a challenge, okay? It is a challenge. There's no question about it. Okay, now. I'm going to sort of take a little bit of a different tack at this point. Not really go off on a different direction, but a different tack. Within Tibetan Buddhism, from the scholarly point of view, it's said that there are two kinds of vehicles. I mean, we're used to the Hinayana, yana meaning vehicle, lower vehicles, or Theravada, which is less insulting, actually. Talk about the Theravada, the vehicle of the elders or the hearers. There's Mahayana, there's Vajrayana, Vajrayana being tantric practice, which is an aspect of Mahayana. But there's another way of talking about vehicles, and I don't know if Geshe-la has shared this with you or not, but the scholars talk about cause vehicles and effect vehicles. Have you heard these terms? Okay. For anybody that's not heard these terms, because I'm seeing some heads going up and down and some heads going to the side, okay. For anyone who's not heard these terms, causal vehicles are practices or methods of accumulating the causes of Buddhahood. You accumulate the cause of Buddhahood by developing your understanding, by cultivating merit, by doing purifications. All of these things create the causes of your becoming a Buddha. But of course, you can't become a Buddha unless you have something within you that will become a Buddha. Because there is a principle in Buddhist logic that like creates like. A dissimilar something cannot create something dissimilar to itself. Okay? So an acorn that would ordinarily create an oak tree cannot create a stalk of corn. Too dissimilar. Won't happen. Okay? So the reason that cause vehicles will, through their efficacy of a collecting merit and whatnot, turn you into a Buddha is because you have the seed of being a Buddha within you. And I'm going to come back to what is that seed of being a Buddha. But effect vehicles do something really different. They go the direction of, well, heck, you've got the seed of Buddha within you, manifest it, and you will become a Buddha. It's not so much that you have to create the causes of Buddhahood, but you have to recognize that Buddhahood is within you and you manifest it through insight. Now, ultimately, actually, those two things aren't all that different from each other. Because in order to have the insight to manifest your Buddha nature, which is already within you, you got to work at it, which is to say accumulate an awful lot of merit and so on and so forth, right? And of course, you couldn't become a Buddha, as I said, and accumulate the causes of Buddhahood unless you had the capacity within you, right? So they're actually two aspects of the same thing, two sides of one coin, if you will. But they do function a little bit differently in terms of practice. And for anybody, by the way, that's kind of moved through the Zen world before coming here, Zen is a effect vehicle or an effect vehicle, because Zen functions on the basis of understanding that if you just, for example, in the Suzuki Roshi tradition of, Soto Zen, thank you, Kay, in the Soto Zen tradition, right, 73-year-old neurons problem, right? In the Soto Zen tradition, they say if you just sit still, I think it's called Shikan Tanza, if you just sit still upright and do nothing else, your Buddha nature emerges. You become Buddha on that basis, that practice. Well, that can only work because you have the Buddha nature. Now, in their view, by achieving ultimate stillness, this comes forward. In the Tibetan view, or the Vajrayana view, you achieve stillness in a very different kind of way, and it looks quite different also, by the way, but it's based on the same principle. So I found it very easy to go back and forth between the Soto Zen tradition, whose name I couldn't remember, and the Vajrayana tradition, because they're both effect vehicles, and this is really what I practice. Okay. So how does it work as an effect vehicle in Vajrayana? What is the seed that becomes Buddha within you? It's called the clear light mind. And the clear light mind is actually something that we momentarily access during the 24 hours of waking, dreaming, and sleep. It's already there. And upon it, we create our own Buddhahood through the tools of the effect vehicles, like Vajrayana. Right? So, typically, it's said that you encounter clear light consciousness at the moment of death. Because what happens at the moment, what happens in the death process, is all the elements of the body serially collapse. Technically, the way it's described is the solid aspects of yourself melt into the liquid aspects of yourself. The liquid aspects of yourself melt into fiery aspects. The fiery aspects melt into wind aspects. The wind aspects melt into consciousness aspects. White light occurs. Red light occurs. Black light occurs. You faint. And then the clear light of death passes you by because you're not capable of seeing it. The great lamas prepare for this, right? And they know it's coming. And when the moment of actual, just not quite death, because if you were dead, you wouldn't experience it, but just at the edge of death when the clear light occurs, because they've been practicing, because they know how to find it during the 24-hour cycle, they sit in it. And at that time, that clear light mind is called the wisdom mind of bliss voidness. You may have heard this. The wisdom mind of bliss voidness. It's consciousness aware of the true nature of consciousness, which is beatific or blissful and void in the sense of it understands its own nature as being not solid, not independent, so on and so forth, and as being blissful or beatific. Okay. So the whole Vajrayana practice as an effect vehicle is predicated on the fact that the clear light mind is already there within you. You just don't typically run into it. But that doesn't mean you can't practice with it. And more importantly, it doesn't mean you can't practice with a similitude of it, which is then the basis really of Vajrayana practice. You're practicing with that similitude. Okay. All right. It's now 45 minutes into this talk, and from my point of view, that's a good time to take a break on that particular note. Then I'll come back to this, and then I'm going to connect it with Guru Yoga and more with practice. And eventually, we'll hook into Madhyamaka. And if not today, then some other time. Okay? All right. All righty. So, questions about where we were just at with similitudes, practicing with similitudes, and the potency of being able to practice with similitude. Okay. By the way, for what it's worth, for those of you who are interested in such things, this particular concept also appears in Nagarjuna's texts, where he talks about things happening in the conventional realm of reality, even though ultimately speaking, you can't ascertain that those things are there. But they have potency, they have functionality, and there are a lot of verses about that. And this is really quite an important point in Buddhism, because one of the things that I have always felt distinguishes the Buddhist view of reality, ontology is, I guess, the technical word for this in the philosophy departments, from most of the Hindu views of reality, is that it's not that this world we live in, this world of appearances, is completely unreal, and the whole point of spiritual practice is getting out of here into the place which is real. But rather, Buddhism has this idea of the two truths, which is to say that appearance has its own reality. And it's not the ultimate reality of things, which is the emptiness of appearances, but you can't have the ultimate reality of things, which is the emptiness of appearances, without the appearances. So the appearances end up being very important. And this, of course, becomes a foundation of the entirety of compassion and compassion practices. So the idea that you merely withdraw from the world and you ignore the world to pursue reality, period, is quite not Buddhist, because you may withdraw from the world to understand the nature of reality, but once you understand the nature of reality, you're back in the world, because world and reality are not two separate things. And I've kind of felt that there's that distinction between the more Hindu views and the more Buddhist views. This isn't absolute. This is sort of a thumbnail concept. And there are different approaches, even within the Hindu world, in regards to this. For example, Ramakrishna comes to my mind as somebody who was very attuned to other realities. But if you look at what all of his students did in terms of how they functioned as teachers and how their organizations or their followers function, they're very much engaged in the world and taking care of the world, right? So, this is not an absolute line, but it's sort of a tendency that I've seen. All right, so I guess that's a sidebar. We'll come back to, okay. Okay, so there are no questions about where we ended up. All right. Yes?
Sometimes I know with perhaps some of the literature that I've seen would use resultant vehicle a lot instead of the other one, so in case people have seen that.
Resultant vehicle rather than result vehicle?
Versus
effect vehicle, yeah. Cause and effect or cause and result. Thank you for clarifying that. Yeah, because it's easy to get lost in the language. Again, that's very much a middle way philosophy view, is that language is really essential to get us into the practice and to get us where we want to go. But it's easy to get so tangled up in the words that we don't get to where we want to go. And we end up going around in circles. I think that I don't know if this is apocryphal, but there was this idea that the Buddhist teachings are like a raft something that takes you to the other shore, across the river of samsara, takes you to the other shore. Well, once you get to the other shore, the aphorism was, you don't put the raft on your back and drag it across, you leave it, and you're on the other shore. You don't need the raft anymore. And the raft is like the language. It's like the words. They get you someplace, but they can also be a problem if you don't let go of them. So there's an opportunity for an aphorism. Thank you. Back to this clear light mind. So this is the essential thing. As Tara Rinpoche said, the clear light mind is the basis upon which you go to Buddhahood. Practicing with a clear light mind is the basis upon which you go to Buddhahood. So practicing with a similitude of it, which is what we experience in dreamless sleep, is part of this process. Gesundheit. So now I want to relate this to the Lama. Because I was really very strident, I guess might be the word, a week ago in talking about how important the Lama is for practice. I don't think I'm exactly off when I say the Lama is important for practice, because the Lama is important for practice. But I didn't say exactly why, okay, besides the fact that we're devoted to the Lamas and they teach us everything we need to know, if that weren't enough. But there's more. Because the Lama is someone who has realized, the true Lama, is someone who has realized or manifest within themselves, within their own mind stream, within their own practice, the clear light consciousness, the consciousness of bliss voidness. It's within them. It's not merely potential, but it's active within them. Right? So when the Lama is doing the initiation, for example, what's happening is the Lama as the wisdom mind of bliss voidness manifests as the Yidam in doing the initiation. That's a mouthful, okay? So let me try and clarify what I'm trying to say here, is that when the Lama does the initiation, and I talked about the Lama as sort of like the yogurt starter, you know, last week, like in order to, for you to become yogurt, you have to have the yogurt starter, and the Lama is like the yogurt starter that enters into you. The Lama becomes the Yidam in the process of doing the initiation, but the reason that the Lama can actually become the Yidam, not just a similitude of the Yidam, but actually the Sambhogakaya Yidam appears within the Lama's stream of consciousness, is because the Lama has cultivated the clear light mind within herself or within himself, right? That clear light mind is what becomes the Yidam and the Lama. And that clear light mind is what the Lama introduces you to in the initiation. So the Lama introduces you to Tara, for example, when you receive the Tara initiation. But when introducing you to Tara, what you're being introduced to is actually the clear light mind in the form of Tara, in the form of the physical Lama who is sitting with you. And all these things are there at the same time. Now, when you're taking the initiation, you have to use your imagination to get it. I mean, it helps to know what it is you're trying to imagine, for starters, okay? That's the reason I'm sitting here talking with you, right? It helps to know what it is that you need to imagine. But the true Lama is actually that which you're imagining, because you can't see it. You know, they say that you can't see the Sambhogakaya Buddhas. That's the tradition. You can't see the Sambhogakaya Buddhas, even though they're there all the time. Tara is in the room with us right now, but none of us see Tara. Okay, but if the Lama is here doing an initiation, Tara is the Lama at that time, and you meet Tara. It helps to have an imagination, but there are other ways to know that that's the case also. Sometimes you hear people talking about the grace of the Lama or the blessings of the Lama. So what are they talking about? I mean, grace and blessings can seem to us to be very abstract. Like, oh, yeah, well, you know, the Lama is very kindly giving me this teaching, or the Lama is very kindly giving me this initiation. That's the grace of the Lama. That's very nice. But I don't think that that's the whole story. And now we loop back to this teaching about consciousness and wind, about consciousness being like the rider on the horse. If the Lama is manifesting as Tara, if the image of Tara has appeared so totally in the mind stream of the Lama that the Lama doesn't understand themselves as, I'm Lama Yeshe, but rather I'm Tara, because the great Lamas do that, right? There's an energy that goes with that experience. There's a wind energy that's associated with Tara. It's different than the wind energy that's associated with Manjushri. The wind energy that's associated with Manjushri is associated with the wisdom function of the mind, right? It's our capacity to have the wisdom to understand emptiness. The Tara function that's associated with the winds is different. It's associated with compassion, it's associated with purification of vows, and a number of other things, because Tara has many features. Seems like Manjushri has fewer features than Tara to me, fewer sides, if you will. Okay, so that wind energy is there, right? And remember I was saying last week that if you have two guitars in a room that are tuned to each other, if you strike a chord on one guitar, the strings on the other guitar will resonate with that chord, okay? When the true Lama is there manifesting in the form of the Yidam, there's an energy that's in that Lama and it enters you. You can feel it. It's tangible, unless you're just the kind of person that's not capable of noticing that stuff. But I think everybody in this room is perfectly capable of noticing that stuff. You know, you can feel it. When Kay and I first met Lhotso Rinpoche in Dharamsala, my experience was like honey dripping out of the sky, dripping on me. And when we walked out, I turned to Kay and I said, and this is the first time we met him, I said, our lives are not going to be the same. You know, it was like, it was tangible and it was sweet. It wasn't sticky, but we stuck nevertheless, even though it wasn't sticky. First time I was in the Dalai Lama's presence, which was the gymnasium, Amherst College, not exactly an elevated location, sitting in the bleachers, as he walked in, I felt flowers falling on my head. It was distinct. It was like somebody stood behind me and took a bushel basket of roses and just poured them over my head. So these great beings who manifest these Sambhogakaya Buddhas in their mind streams, there's an impact. There's an impact around, and you can feel it. And that's part of what happens in initiation also, that's transmitted. Now, this is my view. I've never met a Lama who said, yeah, that's what's going on. You know, they don't talk about these things very much, which is sort of peculiar and a kind of a pain, because, you know, it's like, please explain to me more about what's going on here. And you don't get it. It's sort of like going to them with a dream. What does that dream mean? Oh, yeah, it's just a dream, don't, you know. Or you have a vision and you go to them with a vision and say, what about this? You don't tend to get answers, you know. I don't tend to get answers. I don't know, maybe you got answers, but I don't get answers. No, I see some heads shaking. They don't give answers. So what I'm trying to do here is, you know, sort of, as the academics say, unpack some of this stuff, okay? So I take it to be very real, but I take it to be real based upon my experience of having this kind of an experience, based upon my experience of having this experience, right? That was coherent, all right? But you get the idea, okay? And that was the reason why I stressed this idea about the relationship of consciousness and wind. Now, there's another question that comes up at this point. And this is where we start slipping into talking about middle way philosophy. If the Lama becomes the Yidam, and you are introduced to the Yidam through the Lama, and it's said that there's a way in which there's a merger between the Lama Yidam and yourself. For example, if I go back to the green Tara Sadhana that you're doing here at Tubta Norbuling, there's a place in the sadhana, and pardon me if I don't get the language quite correctly, but I'm sure I'll be corrected, which is fine. That's not a problem. Okay. There's a point where in the sadhana it says that the Lama deity, Tara, and you become one. So how is that possible? You know, how is that possible for you and the Lama to become one, to be the same? Because you're obviously not the same, but you're obviously the same within this context. So what is going on? How does the mind grasp this? Okay, so that's why I said we shift into talking about middle way philosophy. or Madhyamaka here. So I've asked this question of a number of lamas. How does this work? How is this possible? And they say that we're all of one taste. They don't really say that we're exactly, they don't say that we're the same in the sense of like, there's no difference between you and me. For example, I asked Lhotso Rinpoche, he was doing some teachings on Yamantaka with us. And he was saying that, you know, you practice, and you become enlightened in the form of Yamantaka. And I said, okay, so if Kay practices, she becomes enlightened in the form of Yamantaka. I become enlightened in the form of Yamantaka. Lhotso Rinpoche, you're already in the form of Yamantaka, because he was the lineage holder. He was, even though we couldn't necessarily see it, unless, except when he got fierce with us, which did happen. So are we all the same? Are we the same Yamantaka? Are we the same Buddha when we get enlightened? Or are we different? Well, the Dalai Lama stresses that we all have individual mind streams. That we do. There's not just one mind and we're sort of manifestations of it. Like a tree and we're all different leaves of that tree, but really there's just one tree. That's the Hindu view of reality. That's the relationship of Atman and Brahman. And the Buddhists are very, nope, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about something else. So he said, well, we're all of the same taste in the sense of we're all Yamantakas whose nature is bliss void. And your bliss void is the same nature as my bliss void. But you're you and I'm me. And yet our bliss voids are of the same taste, of the same character. So that seems to be the answer to how it's possible for the Lama within you to be one with you, even though the Lama is obviously not one with you, because the Lama's over here and you're over there. And maybe you're a woman and the Lama's a guy, or the other way around. Whatever the case may be, there's obviously a difference. But the essence somehow is the same. Okay. Now, the reason I say that we need to understand this within the context of Madhyamaka, middle way philosophy, is because the basic view that exists in middle way philosophy is that all the phenomena that we experience in the world, all the thoughts that we have, are constructs which are provisional. They don't have a fundamental reality. For example, the only way you know the difference between left and right is you know that right is not left. I mean, truly, that's the only way you know the difference between left and right. I mean, we're raised to have an organic sense of this is my left arm and that's my right arm. Okay? But if you think of left and right in abstract ways, left and right depend on each other. Right defines left by being not left. Left defines, if I say this, it's going to sound weird. Left defines right by being not right, because we have, you know, right has different meanings. Maybe it's better to say we know the difference between north and south because south is not north. Or we know the difference, actually, between hot and cold in the same way. All right, anyhow, they define each other by relationship. This is fundamental Madhyamaka. And so the Madhyamaka view is that at any given moment, we're looking out at a world which is transitory and insubstantial. We don't see the world changing. We see the world as solid, right? But if we really dwell on this with any thoughtfulness, we recognize that the world is not solid. It's constantly changing. This is what impermanence means. It's constantly changing, and to the extent that we resist the fact of it constantly changing, we're made miserable because it's going to change. What I always used to tell my academic students was, if you have the good fortune to be able to buy a new car, I highly recommend that you go out very quickly, with a key and scrape it. That way, you don't have to worry about your car getting scraped, which is inevitable, right? Because it's the nature of change that it's going to happen. You're going to get banged in parking lots. You're going to hit tree branches. Stop worrying about it. It's going to happen. And if you really want to worry about it, preempt the problem, you know? Well, nobody ever did that I know. But my point was, we don't accept the fact that change exists. I look in the mirror every morning, and believe me, I do not see a 73-year-old man. It's kind of like, what happened? Well, we know what happened, because it's just the way it is. I mean, what's the alternative? Well, you know, as they say, what's the alternative to growing old? It's not really much better. Okay. So we don't accept change. We don't accept that what we see as being solid is in fact not solid. The other thing we don't accept is that everything that we experience is made up of parts. We think everything is solid. It's not very hard to look at something and you can realize it's made up of parts. You know, you look at your sweater, it's made up of threads, right? But also if you look at your sweater, you recognize that it's dependently originated in the sense that it used to be a sheep and it passed through a lot of hands before it became your sweater. You know, and there's a lot of meditation you can do on dependent arising. But the thing is, in any given moment, you just see everything as if it's just there, right? Okay. The other thing, and these are like the three major themes for meditation that you can do in the context of Vajrayana practice, by the way. So I'm telling you where I'm going to go before I get there, okay? The other thing is that everything you experience, you label. You put a concept on it. You put meaning on it. You attribute some value to it. You know, it's not just there. I mean, the sweater is beautiful. The car is wonderful because it's new and it has that new car smell. Ignore the fact that you're making outrageous payments every month and that the insurance company is going to gouge you because of whatever, you know. You just see this beautiful car there, right? But in fact, it's made of parts, and there's a very long dialogue in which Nagasena has the chutzpah to talk to a king who comes to visit him in northwest India a couple thousand years ago. And they have a very long dialogue about the king's chariot, and Nagasena challenges the king to show him the chariot, which the king in the end can't do because Nagasena says, well, where is it? Is it in the wheels? Is it in the axle? Is it in the platform that you're standing on? Is it in the spokes? Where's the chariot? Where's the chariot? And finally the king says, no, it's in the concatenation of all the parts that you find the chariot. And Nagasena says, right. Chariot is a concatenation of dependently originated elements upon which you've designated a label. It's the chariot. And there is nothing else there besides that. Same for a human being. We all know this particular routine. So why is it that we're stuck on this idea that the Lama and I, even though we're of one taste, are fundamentally separate, or we're the same? The problem is that our minds, thank you so much, Mary, for rescuing me. The problem is that our minds insist on it's either the same or it's different, because our minds are binary in the same way as left defines right and right defines left. Same and different define each other, okay? But that's our minds. Now, where is our mind in the larger scheme of things that we've been talking about here? Okay. Our mind is something that is a quality, if you will, or an expression of the clear light nature of what we actually are. Okay. The best way to understand this, and I'm going to wrap up with this because we're going to be running out of time. The best way to understand this is that one of the oldest Buddhist teachings is that every sense experience can be understood as a sense object, a sense organ, and a consciousness coming together. So a visual sense, for example, I'm seeing you and I'm seeing the yellow sweater. There is something there. There is my eye, which is perceiving that, and there's my consciousness that's aware of it. The consciousness that's associated with my ears that hears sound, so sound is sound waves coming to my ear organ, sense organ, and my ear consciousness, okay, those two consciousnesses, the consciousness of sound and the consciousness of sight, are not fundamentally different. They're only different in the sense that they're connected with a different sense organ. But as consciousness, there's no fundamental difference, whatever consciousness is, whatever awareness is, which we're not going to try and define right now. The same for smell, taste, touch, and here's the one that's always hard for people, thought. In the Buddhist framework, the mind is a sense organ. Needs to be understood as a sense organ, but it's not a material sense organ. Fundamentally, what the mind is a cognition of the previous moment of cognition. It's consciousness of the previous moment of consciousness. And this is a little hard to grasp, and we're running out of time, so I'm not going to belabor it, but I want to wrap up. The clear light mind is not fundamentally different in its character than the consciousness which is aware of the previous moment of consciousness. Okay? And the reason that we don't experience that is because we're so wrapped up in the sense organs and the experience of the sense organs as being different, and the thoughts that are occurring to the mind, which are based upon this binary distinction, that we can't actually see what's going on. We can't get past the binariness of the previous moment of thought to see the nature of consciousness itself. And because we can't see the nature of consciousness itself, even though it's with us all the time, we never experience the clear light nature of mind. But the great lamas see this, and they're not stuck by the thoughts. They're not stuck by the binaries. They're not stuck by the, well, yeah, I'm either the same as the lama or I'm different than the lama. They're in a different place completely. They're up at the 30,000 foot altitude looking at what's really going on. Now, having said all of that, I can't say anything more about it. Because if I said anything more about it, I would still be stuck in the binary nature of the mind trying to point at this clear light consciousness, which I've said you can experience either as a similitude when you're asleep and not dreaming, or directly just before you die. There are other ways to experience it also, by the way. For example, if you sneeze. Well, think about this. Think about the last time you had a really good sneeze. Did you zip out? Were you aware of what was happening at that particular moment? Probably not, you know. Orgasm is supposed to be another moment where you zip out and there's this kind of like oneness which is not describable. Fainting is supposed to be like that too. You know, if you get up too quickly, if you're sitting and you have kind of like a head rush, I think is the term for that, and you just go psht, same thing. Okay, so this is the main point. To summarize, this is the main point. Everything about this practice requires, on the one hand, you have to use your mind, you have to analyze, you need to understand how the distinctions work, and at the same time, you have to step beyond your mind. And one of the tools for doing this in Vajrayana is the images, because the thing about images is they're not strictly binary, right? A poem can have many meanings. A myth can have many meanings. An image in your dream can have many meanings. It doesn't only mean one thing. It can mean many things, right? So it's like this intermediary step between the rigid dualities of waking consciousness and the source consciousness, which is the pure light, the clear light mind, which is the vehicle that finally takes you, that actually takes you to Buddhahood. Okay? All right. I think that's a great place to stop. Oh, questions. Okay, we're not stopping. All right.
Well, I don't know when I'm going to have you again.
I don't know. You have to ask Mary.
I know, but just in case, I have to, like, get it out.
Go ahead, ask.
So when you're doing Guru Devi Yoga practice, Guru Yidam practice, or however you want, yeah, then when you're visualizing the deity, what is the relationship that's happening there as you're visualizing the deity? Because you're working on a couple different levels.
Right. So my sense is that you're in a combination of dream consciousness and waking consciousness, for one thing, right? So your waking consciousness is saying we're separate, or your waking consciousness is saying we're the same. Meanwhile, your dream consciousness is experiencing yourself as being the same and separate at the same time without any difficulty at all, because your dream consciousness doesn't have a problem with that. Because it's not bound by that duality, right? So that's the power of using that. Plus, if you've really been cultivating the practice, your waking consciousness in the midst of all this is saying to you, oh, by the way, really, this is clear light voidness appearing in the form of Tara. And if you're really into it, then Tara appears as clear light bliss voidness in that experience, even though she has the form of Tara, because she's not limited by being solid, non-dependent, and she's not strictly designated by a limited consciousness. I don't know a better way to express this. But all this stuff is happening at the same time in the deepest practice. So your rational mind's there, your dream mind is there, and the actual foundation experience is there all at the same time. That's like the three bodies coming together. Or it's like being awake, dreaming, and sound asleep all at the same time.
That's so cool.
It's a challenge. But you can do it. I mean, it's doable. I mean, if I could have glimpses of that experience, anybody can, believe me. Mary, did you have a...
But what you were saying also, the clear light, the rainbow bodies, which is what we've been in, you know, in the directions when we leave the sadhana, just even visualizing things as a, idams as a rainbow body, that in itself is hinting to eventually clear light.
It is, but the rainbow body is a little bit of a different something.
Okay,
because when you master the practice, you actually... you actually become the Yidam. And when you actually become the Yidam in kind of a physical sense, you're no longer bound by your physical body. You're kind of out there in mental space, which doesn't exactly make any sense at all. But every thought form is associated with an energy, and the energy is the, quote, physical body of the Yidam in psychic space, for lack of a better way of talking about it. And at this point in time...
But is that... So then you were speaking to how the Yidam functions before you become one with Yidam. Because there is a functionality to the Yidam. It's not just emptiness. It also functions.
It does. But in this case, I was talking about something different.
Okay, sorry.
No, that's okay. In this case, I was talking about... if you achieve realization of the practices of highest yoga tantra, when you die, you don't go into the bardo. When you die, you take on the body of a yidam. You become a Sambhogakaya Buddha. That's one of the purposes of the practice. You avoid the bardo entirely. And so how do you exist? Well, your physical body is gone, but your energy body is there, and that's supporting the yidam in mental space.
And then from there, you can manifest in Nirmanakaya. You have
that would be the consequence, is you would manifest in Nirmanakaya instead of in an ordinary human body at the end of the period of time. But this becomes incomprehensible to talk about, because the other issue is, what does time mean for a Sambhogakaya Buddha? It's not what time means for us, because for us, time is past, present, and future. We understand future on the basis of present. We understand past on the basis of present. We define past and future on the basis of each other in our own minds. But the Sambhogakāya Buddhas are not in that space where they're limited by the duality of mind. So what does time mean for them? And so this is really a very important issue. And it's also connected with Guru Yoga. Because what does it mean for me to be able to practice with the presence of Denmalocho Rinpoche, even though he died a few years ago? But I can practice with his presence right now. I've been doing it all morning. Before I came here, that's how I prepared to do the talk. Right. What we think of as time is really limited by the way our minds function. And this is pure Madhyamaka. I mean, Nagarjuna takes time and he just shreds the concept that we usually have, you know. So that's why I also say, you know, Madhyamaka is the foundation for understanding Vajrayana. There's another question back here.
How about lucid dreaming?
I mentioned that last week, and lucid dreaming is a great example of how the waking conscious mind can merge with the dream conscious mind and affect changes.
There's a writer called Stéphane Laberge.
What's that?
There's a man, writer, called Stéphane Laberge.
Oh, right, at Stanford. He's the one who's done the major research on this. Yes. Right. And that's a very important thing to understand because it's a kind of scientific validation of the way in which dream consciousness and waking consciousness can not only connect, but how things can be changed in our character based upon our ability to lucid dream. So traumas can be dealt with and fears can be dealt with.
Never ends.
What's that?
It never ends.
It never ends.
There's always something.
That's true. That's a great way to end. It never ends. There's always something. So, as always, we want to end by dedicating the energy we've accumulated together in talking about this for the benefit of all beings, which includes ourselves, which is important to remember.